Chapter 14. The Hidden City. While the hours I'd wasted hunting for Elodine's books left me profoundly irritated, I emerged from the experience with a solid working knowledge of the archives. The most important thing I learned was that it was not merely a warehouse filled with books. The archives was like a city unto itself. It had roads and winding lanes. It had alleys and shortcuts. Just like a city, parts of the archives teemed with activity. The scriptorium held rows of desks where scribes toiled over translations or copied faded texts into new books with fresh dark ink. The sorting hall buzzed with activity as scribes sifted and reshelved books. The buggery was not at all what I expected, thank goodness. Instead, it proved to be the place where new books were decontaminated before being added to the collection. Apparently all manner of creatures love books, some devouring parchment and leather, others with a taste for paper or glue. Bookworms were the least of them, and after listening to a few of Willem's stories, I wanted nothing more than to wash my hands. Cataloguer's mew, the bindery, bolts, palimpsest, all of them were busy as beehives, full of quiet, industrious scribs. But other parts of the archives were quite the opposite of busy. The acquisitions office, for example, was tiny and perpetually dark. Through the window I could see that one entire wall of the office was nothing but a huge map, with cities and roads marked in such detail that it looked like a snarled loom. The map was covered in a layer of clear alchemical lacquer, and there were notes written at various points in red grease pencil, detailing rumors of desirable books and the last known positions of the various acquisition teams. Tomes was like a great public garden. Any student was free to come and read the books shelved there, or they could submit a request to the scribes, who would grudgingly head off into the stacks to find if not the exact book you wanted, then at least something closely related. But the stacks comprised the vast majority of the archives. That was where the books actually lived, and just like in any city, there were good neighborhoods and bad. In the good neighborhoods, everything was properly organized and catalogued. In these places, a ledger entry would lead you to a book as simply as a pointing finger. Then there were the bad neighborhoods, sections of the archives that were forgotten, or neglected, or simply too troublesome to deal with at the moment. These were places where books were organized under old catalogues or under no catalogue at all. There were walls of shelves like mouths with missing teeth, where long-gone scribes had cannibalized an old catalogue to bring books into whatever system was fashionable at the time. 30 years ago, two entire floors had gone from good neighborhood to bad when the Larkin Ledger books were burned by a rival faction of scribes. And of course, there was the four-plate door, the secret at the heart of the city. It was nice to go strolling in the good neighborhoods. It was pleasant to go looking for a book and find it exactly where it should be. It was easy, comforting, quick. But the bad neighborhoods were fascinating. The books there were dusty and disused. When you opened one, you might read words no eyes had touched for hundreds of years. There was treasure there, among the dross. It was in those places I searched for the Chandrian. I looked for hours, and I looked for days. A large part of the reason I had come to the university was because I wanted to discover the truth about them. Now that I finally had easy access to the archives, I made up for lost time. But despite my long hours of searching, I found hardly anything at all. There were several books of children's stories that featured Chandrian engaged in minor mischief, like stealing pies and making milk go sour. Others had them bargaining like demons in a Turan morality plays. Scattered through these stories were a few thin threads of fact, but nothing I didn't already know. The Chandrian were cursed. Signs showed their presence, blue flame, rot and rust, a chill in the air. My hunt was made more difficult by the fact that I couldn't ask anyone for help. If word spread that I was spending my time reading children's stories, it would not improve my reputation. More important, one of the few things I knew about the Chandrian was that they worked to viciously repress any knowledge of their own existence. They'd killed my troop because my father had been writing a song about them. In Trebon, they destroyed an entire wedding party because some of the guests had seen pictures of them on a piece of ancient pottery. Given these facts, talking about the Chandrian didn't seem like the wisest course of action. So I did my own searching. After days, I abandoned hope of finding anything so helpful as a book about the Chandrian, or even anything so substantial as a monograph. Still, I read on, hoping to find a scrap of truth hidden somewhere, a single fact, a hint, anything. But children's stories are not rich in detail, and what few details I found were obviously fanciful. Where did the Chandrian live? In the clouds? In dreams? In a castle made of candy? What were their signs? Thunder? The darkening of the moon? One story even mentioned rainbows. Who would write that? Why make a child terrified of rainbows? Names were easier to come by, but all were obviously stolen from other sources. Almost all of these were names of demons mentioned in the Book of the Path, or from some play, primarily Deonica. One painfully allegorical story named the Chandrian after 7 well-known emperors from the days of the Aturan Empire. That at least gave me a brief, bitter laugh. Eventually, I discovered a slim volume called The Book of Secrets, buried deep in the dead ledgers. It was an odd book, arranged like a bestiary but written like a children's primer. It had pictures of fairy tale creatures like ogres, trow, and denelings. Each entry had a picture accompanied by a short, insipid poem. Of course, the Chandrian were the only entry without a picture. Instead, there was just an empty page framed in decorative scrollwork. The accompanying poem was less than useless. The Chandrian move from place to place, but they never leave a trace. They hold their secrets very tight, but they never scratch and they never bite. They never fight and they never fuss. In fact, they are quite nice to us. They come and they go in the blink of an eye, like a bright bolt of lightning out of the sky. Irritating as it was to read something like this, it made one point abundantly clear. To the rest of the world, the Chandrian were nothing more than childish fairy stories. No more real than shamblemen or unicorns. I knew differently, of course. I had seen them with my own eyes. I had talked to black-eyed Cinder. I had seen Haliax wearing shadow all around him like a mantle. So I continued my fruitless search. It didn't matter what the rest of the world believed. I knew the truth. And I've never been one to give up easily. I settled into the rhythm of a new term. As before, I attended classes and played music at Anchors. But most of my time was spent in the archives. I had lusted after them for so long that being able to walk through the front doors any time I wanted seemed almost unnatural. Even my continuing failure to find anything factual about the Chandrian didn't sour the experience. As I hunted, I became increasingly distracted by other books I found, a handwritten medicinal herbal with watercolor pictures of various plants, a small quarto book of 4 plays I'd never heard of before, a remarkably engaging biography of Hevred the Wary. I spent entire afternoons in the reading halls, missing meals and neglecting my friends. More than once, I was the last student out of the archives before the Scrivs locked the doors for the night. I would have slept there if such things were allowed. Some days, if my schedule was too tight for me to settle in for a long stretch of reading, I would simply walk the stacks for a handful of minutes between classes. I was so infatuated with my new freedoms that I did not make it over the river into Imray for many days. When I did return to the Grey Man, I brought a calling card I'd fashioned from a scrap of parchment. I thought Denner would be amused by it. But when I arrived, the officious porter in the Grey Man's parlour told me no, he could not deliver my card. No, the young lady was no longer in residence. No, he could not take a message for her. No, he did not know where she had gone.